Okay, we've now shifted on to tape number two, and this is side A. And I think when I was suddenly interrupted by the click of the last tape, unexpectedly, I was talking about the frogs and the herpetologist, Mr. Wilkinson. When he came up, he got quite excited about this and said, that's something that we're not familiar with in New Zealand. And he phoned off to somebody in Wellington who was a greater authority. And within 24 hours, I think that guy was raced up here, and we were hanging upside down at midnight and around these banks trying to get a close look at one of these confounded frogs, because they were in these rush-like things, the name of which I can never remember. It's a native waterside-growing plant. Looks like a small flax. Anyway, they were in those, and they had such a high-pitched call that... is very, very difficult to tell exactly where the sound... Do you realise that when the pitch gets high, it's very difficult to pinpoint exactly where it comes from. Anyway, by various means, we managed to track these down. And lo and behold, they were a frog that had never been recorded in New Zealand before, and they're not supposed to be here. It was from Adelaide, something Adelaideensis. I can't remember frog names. Plant names are bad enough, but there's a Latin name for this particular frog, and this is the first recording of them in New Zealand. So that was a bit of an interesting natural history side to the job. And I, subsequent to that, and they still here, we didn't know, you see, there were males calling. We didn't know whether there were females here, whether they'd breed or not, because they're not supposed to be here for a start, because it's illegal to bring them in. And, you know, what would be their future, how long do they live sort of thing. So over a few years, I used to record them and track them down every summer. They just call for a period in January when the lighting, you know, was on, which is a busy time anyway. So that added to the busyness, getting a track on these frogs. And I checked on distance, and I would... hear them calling here, and I went right down the lake, and I could actually, their pitch was so strong, you know, so carrying, that I could hear them still, because I knew what I was listening for. Just behind the side here is somebody coming past. It's all right. Just mind the dog, that's the problem. It's okay. Yeah. Come towards me and you're okay. That's it? Very good. What a fantastic dog, eh? Gosh. We've just been passed by a guide dog taking a man for a walk in the park, which is quite remarkable. Yeah. I could hear those frogs at the office right down past the bandstand. Their noise carried the sound of one frog carried all that way on a still summer's night. It was quite incredible. You will hear them now. Still, I heard them last year in the ponds across on this, just across the Struan Walk, you know, across Brooklands Drive corner. So that's an interesting bit of natural history that is unique to Pukekura Park.
Do you have possums in here?
Oh, don't talk to me about possums, please. Possums are one of the brains of... Oh, well, yeah, that's only because I used to shoot about 50 every year, and now you're not allowed to shoot in places like this. I can tell you a whole series of stories about me being out in the middle of the night with a shotgun and the light. We used to spotlight them. And in August, I would come to the oak trees, and, you know, that's where they'd be. I'll tell you more about that when we get up towards the bowl. Yes, possums have been a dreadful thing here. I've seen magnolia trees in the park just about killed with the possums just defoliating.
We were down at Kapiti Island there, and they were telling us about all the possums down there.
Yes.
They used to have down there.
Yeah.
The possums would eat, what, 400 tonnes or 400 tonnes?
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Of vegetation a night.
They are really bad news, a terrible pest. Few people realise just how devastating they can be. They have to be controlled. Yeah. And by one means or another, they've got to be taken out of these sort of areas. Now, we've come almost as far south as you can travel in Pukekura Park, where beside the little stream which enters from the Brooklands Drive, Brooklands Road corner, and almost beside the Goodwin Dell. A few little things from the past here. Behind us is a very, very large Macrocarpa stump. When I came here, there were great Macrocarpa and pine trees up here, and they were taken down probably in the early 80s, I think. Really large trees. And this is where the one source of water, one reliable sort of all-year-round source of water comes in from the Vogeltown area, up through Vogeltown Park, right up to Horry Street. This is the that's the catchment area. Now, I've got a photograph here which was taken roughly where we're standing, looking right back, and you can see Cannon Hill in the distance, right down this valley, strangely enough. You'd have thought it was round the corner, but that's the trick of topography and geography. And it doesn't show clearly here. I have another photograph which I wasn't able to find for you, but this is the path which we're going to travel around in a minute, back to the boat shed, travelling round to the right there. Goes down round to the boat shed where we started. And another photo, and this is the walk we've just come up, that's Hughes Walk up the slope there, going up to Brooklands Drive up there, or Brooklands Road rather. And we're on the lakeside walk, still at that level. And this stream divided here, one going down round towards the boat shed, and the other going round to the left following the path which we've just come along, which links with Hughes Walk. So that's there again, no trees of any consequence. The only trees there of any great significance are the pines that were planted in 1876, and it looks there as if they are about 10 to 15 years old. But in this area, there were no trees at all. These great remus in front of us here, there's a whole stand of them here, not apparent at all unless they're down in that low shrubby vegetation in the photograph. And we're looking back at the hillside where we went up to have a look at the rifle butts, and you can see the bushy totara, young totara, growing up there. So that's just another example of the way things change.
Does that blow dry up in dry weather?
No, the stream in both streams from Brooklands and from Vogeltown Park, they're continuous. They're continuous. They go down, of course, quite a bit and more now than they ever did previously, but they are continuous. Now, we've just come a little bit farther past the culvert through which that water flows in, and we're at one of the entrances to the Goodwin Dell. Now, this dell is mainly azalea mollis, and it's called Goodwin Dell in commemoration of John Goodwin, who was superintendent, first of all, and then ultimately director of parks for New Plymouth. He established the parks department and became director of it, and when a sequence of changes took place, that allowed me, who came in as a to set up the orchid collection that Fred Parker was giving, that allowed me to go up as curator of the whole park. So that was sort of, that's how I came into that position. But John Goodwin had been in charge of the park from 1947, I think it was, and he's a man credited with great foresight and wisdom, and I mean, talking about the numbers of plants that a person can retain, the names of plants and being able to identify them. Jack Goodwin was almost unique in this world, not in New Zealand. He had an international recognition for his knowledge of plants. But one of the great features that he introduced into the park were these open spaces. When he came, it was after the war. There'd been a reasonable amount of neglect that's partly understandable because of manpower problems and that. But he had the wisdom to cut out a lot of the trees, notably the sycamores, which seed and propagate all over the place. They're a real threat in a park like this. He cut those out in great numbers. And there were areas of macrocarpa, and this Goodwin Dell is one of them, and the children's playground is another. And they had to be brought down, you know, they were not of any great significance in terms of the whole park. But he had the wisdom not to replant trees in those areas, but to leave them as open spaces. And at that time, a man called Stead had been breeding Azalea mollis in New Zealand, and that's the whole story in itself, in Islam, near Christchurch. And his plants, for some reason, were becoming available, and John Goodwin had a great knowledge of such things and wonderful contacts. And he was able to get the collection of these Islam Azalea mollis and plant them here in this open space that had been created by the removal of the macrocarpa. And across the road in what is now Struan Walk, Truby King Dell, that was in the 50s. The little plaque up on the corner here, we won't go into the dell because we're going on back to the boat shed, but the little plaque there suggests that he created the, it's a little bit misworded. Oh, the problems we had with getting those signs together, believe me. Signposting and signs are a real nightmare. Anyway, unfortunately, there was a miswording there which suggests that he created the Azalea mollis, but it's not quite that. He was responsible for bringing the Azalea mollis and creating that dell. That was what was intended. But it just got mixed up somewhere along the line, you know, like passing a message along through half a dozen people. And the person who actually pushes the levers and does the things doesn't really understand anything about what it's all about anyway. So I just wanted to correct that slight error. But it's a great credit, you know, it's a very appropriate recognition of John Goodwin's work here. And in amongst them, in the middle of it, is one of his favourite plants, the North American cornus, I'm sorry. Big white leaf. It doesn't grow very well here. It's mild, too mild for it. But we had him photographed beside that tree because that was one of his favourite trees. And of course, he got one in his little dell. And it's still there. It struggles along. The borer gets into it, gives it a hard time. And it's not cold enough for it here, but it does survive. There's another tree just looking back to the south in the corner there. The nut, pecan, the pecan nut from North America. Here, yeah, it's one of the walnut family, and you can see the leaves of it. It's a deciduous tree, of course, and that's one of the first pecans planted around here, anyway. But every year, the borer gives it a really hard time, and those should be big trees now, great consequence. And producing pecan nuts, which I'd be interested in, but I don't know whether we'll ever see nuts from them. It's just one of those things that has a little bit of a struggle in our climate here. Is there any questions anybody wants to ask at this stage? We go for a bit of a re-march now to the next point. We're going to walk down the stream flowing into further down into Pukekura Park towards the boat shed bridge where we started. So that's would complete the first loop of our figure eight, and I haven't even looked at the time, but that's where we're making for now. Right, now we're back where we started from. We've done an anti-clockwise circuit over the Boatshed Bridge and around the Goodwin Dell area back to this area of grass, and from here we will now carry on up the other fork of the stream, the other fork where a stream comes down from Brooklyn's Bowl. The Monument Hill I didn't point out. I started to tell you about that originally, and I forgot to point out that in the 1970s, a conifer collection was put on there, And we used to mow that with a gravity mower in those days. So that'll give an indication of the transformation. The way plants grow in this climate is unbelievable. So that represents a fairly general collection of conifers. We're now going up towards the bowl, and we can hear the joyful shouts from families out in the boats. This is as far up the stream as the boats are able to go.
Were you going to mention the age of this?
Yes. So we're coming to a couple of significant kauri now. Remember I told you the story of the demise of these native trees out here. Fortunately, this kauri, which is the first of a group, was not affected adversely. And somebody's asked me the age of it. Well, it's almost certainly, we haven't got an exact planting date, but it's almost certainly one of a group that were put in about 1935, 36, when Duncan and Davies, the big nursery here, somehow produced thousands and thousands of kauri trees. And in fact, they gave one to every school in Taranaki. And even in South Taranaki, you'll find in many schools to this day a kauri tree about that size and about that high. And they all originate from that one distribution. They're a little over 30 centimetres, about 35 centimetres now, and since they grow at about a foot a year in average here, they will grow much faster than that in an ideal site, but my observations indicate that generally they grow about a foot a year in this area. And what does that make it? 1935 to 95 is what, 60 years? So it's in about the 50 to 55 feet range now. So with that knowledge, I can almost be certain that it's from that group. However, just around the corner, well, when I say around the corner, a little bit further towards the bowl of Brooklands, we come to the first kauri that was planted. There's a spot on a tree. That looks dangerous. That's a totara tree, as it says there. A very nice sign on that, and very souvenirable. If you want a souvenir of Pukekura Park, why not take one of those sort of things? And that's what happened to the cursus down there, presumably, which we looked at a little while ago. Incidentally, the Friends of the Park volunteered to attach these signs, so the group has an association with those signs, and it's great to have them. They're very nice signs in a group of native trees. But we've now come to this largest of the kauris in the park, and this was the first kauri that was planted. We're now only 30 metres from that grass patch on our way up to the bowl of Brooklands, and there used to be a sign on this which indicated that it was the first kauri in the park. I should have looked up the exact reference, because we have on record a letter from W.W. Smith giving the history of the planting of this tree. I thought the sign was still there, but it's gone. I think it was about 1910 when this kauri was planted, and he records the history of it up to its planting. I think it was a tree of a few years old then. That's not the first kauri in New Plymouth or Taranaki. Incidentally, the biggest plantings of kauri in the country, at least up until relatively recently, the last few years, was in the city of New Plymouth, where I believe there are about 4,000 kauri trees within the city limits. That's the original city limits, not the new city limits. Because, you see, it was never found this far south. And, of course, if you wanted something different in the native field, you planted a kauri tree. And they thought they were very, very tender in early days. And there are records of certain men who, fathers and their wives, accused them of paying more attention to the kauri tree than their children, because they used to run out, wrap it up at night from the frost. And they will actually stand a reasonable amount of frost. And very, very happy in the Taranaki climate. In fact, down further towards the main lake on the western hillside, we had growth rates of 2 feet six, which is what, somewhere around about just over 75, 80 centimetres a year, whereas the average here is 30. But that was in a perfectly ideal site, and trees were growing at a speed that the Forestry Research Institute had difficulty believing at that time. And those trees are under a survey. They're numbered, and every now and every few years they come back and re-measure them just to see what their future might be, because they're encouraging the planting of kauri now and other native trees in forestry development, whereas up until recently it's only been Pinus radiata that was regarded as a practical proposition.
Good examples of the kauri tree in Franklin Park.
Yes, yeah.
Two very big ones.
Yes, they're recorded, their history is recorded too, yeah. Just what's going to happen to that one in front of that house, I don't know.
Well, once it gets very high, it won't really worry him, but at the moment it's keeping us
under. No, I don't know. I think it would worry me if I was living in the house underneath, quite frankly, but there you are. And unfortunately, it's neither this nor the Frankley Road one is a really classic kauri, insofar as they have branched very low down. This is branching at 5 metres and will never be the towering giants that we think of as Tani Mahuta. That one there will be, the one that we're looking a little bit now back to the boatshed bridge. That one will be. That'll be a magnificent tree because it shows absolutely no sign at this point of branching its final branches. And that's important in the kauri. If I can just find a branch here. You'll notice at the end of all of the young branches of kauri, there's a very big sort of shoulder. And it's mostly bark, and the only wood is that little central piece there, which now that's what, about 20 millimetres nearly, and at the butt there it's about 30, 35 millimetres, but the actual wood in it is only less than 10 millimetres. And so that wood is the only link it has with wherever it came from. And on, you'll notice that young tree there, it's got no significant branches. Those will all drop off just like this one has done. And each branch, wherever you find it, adjoined to the next one, it's exactly the same. Even the little ones onto the big ones, and then the bigger ones, the big ones onto the bigger ones. That's the way of the kauri. So it just sheds these branches, and there's no knots in the timber. There's no kauri. The lower trunks of kauri does not have knots. And that's why it's such a superb timber tree.
You're suggesting then the one in Franklin Park will not grow higher, like the without branches, or the trunk itself?
The trunk itself will grow large, but
not upwards.
No, not very much. Not above where it's branching. It'll branch out and then get very, very big branches. And so it's not really a particularly suitable tree to have in a quarter acre section. Mind you, they're planting them down the Ardett Street, so what the hell, you know. It's hard to put the message through, isn't it? But they are magnificent trees, but you see, from the point of view of having them on the roadside, that tree, that branch there at 5 metres on this one is going to drop off any time now, and a good wind move out from under it. That's one that's going to fracture. It's a juvenile, it's expendable, if you like, as far as the tree. Yeah. The next one isn't. You know, it'd take a heck of a storm to get that next one down because it's, 25 centimetres in diameter. And that is the structure of that tree. There's a theory about it, which might be right and might be wrong, might not be right, I mean, but you see, kauri, you cannot collect kauri seed in the sense that you can collect kauri radiata cones. The cones, it's conifer, but the cones do not come down intact, they just shatter on the tree. And you'll find all little bits on the ground here, which, those are the shattered, those little flakes are the shattered kauri cones. So, sorry?
You can sometimes sign.
Oh, you can be lucky sometimes. Yes, they're quite pretty things. They're very globular. But if you're making a living selling, you know, collecting and selling cowrie seed, you've got a problem if you're going to have to scrape around on the ground for them. They're there, but they're hard to collect. So you have to go up the trees, and there's a theory that the easiest trees to collect the seed from were the ones that branched low down. So do you get the story? It could be that the seed that's been distributed is of a strain of tree that is likely to branch lower down. I'm hoping to get into the plantation at Brooklands, on the other side of Brooklands Drive, and you'll see the significance of that in a very big stand of cowrie.
What's the age of the ones over there?
Which ones?
The ones over Brooklands.
About the same as that one there. You'll find they're about the same size, same height. 1935-36. Yeah, yeah. And I'm hoping to finish up there if I don't stop blabbering around here as much as I am. So, okay, now we're leaving the Boatshed Bridge area and we're moving up towards the Rhododendron Dell and on to Bowler Brooklands. Right, well, we're now in the Rhododendron Dell, and I'll just tell you, off record, I was telling you about the preservation of signs. We've noticed several trees where the signs have been stolen. And I won't repeat on tape the story about the one I tried to protect. But there was another situation where a gentleman's toilet, we had the finger signs in those days and they were always white. And we had it on a, these were all above, I mean the first essential is to have them above any signs above reach height. And we did that on a pole for this gentleman's toilet. And some character used to keep on coming and putting a newspaper over it to disguise the fact that it was a gentleman's toilet. I don't know whether he was expecting a lady to walk in there. But time and time again, and we kept on putting this damn thing higher and higher up a tree, you know. And he always seemed to be able to get his bloody newspaper over it somehow. So, I could tell you many stories about signs. Anyway, now we're in the great Rhododendron Dell of Pukekura Park. Now, this dates back to about 1934, when having established the ferneries in 1928 to protect and preserve a collection of New Zealand ferns, and that, remember, was the origin of the ferneries. They didn't have a lot of decorative plants in originally. There were three houses of ferns, because people had expressed concern about the destruction of our forests and the removal of the environment where ferns would survive. So that's way back in 1928. Anyway, having achieved that great success, they went further and felt that a collection of rhododendrons should be established in the park. And to that end, inquiries were made in England for the best collection that could be available. Victor Davies was involved with this, and they wrote over to the big firms over there, and they got they imported what at that time was the finest collection of rhododendrons in New Zealand, and it was planted in this dell. That was possible because of now I've got to be very careful here. I haven't thoroughly studied the documentation on this, but it was the person who paid for the, there was a bequest left, and I can't remember its name now, but anyway, the main gates were a part of the what was developed from that bequest, and some more of the money was used to establish this rhododendron collection. So many of these plants we're now looking at are, what does that make them, 34, just over 60 years old. Yeah. Yeah, so that's another tribute to the foresight.
The Saunders.
Saunders bequest, I think that's right. Yeah, good one. Pretty sure that's the one. Yeah, it was taken from the Saunders bequest. Now, prior to that, and this is a mystery to me, somewhere there was a maze in Pukekura Park. There was a maze in Pukekura Park, and I'm not sure that anybody's been able to establish exactly where it was, but I I have a feeling that it could have been here in this rhododendron dell. I think that link has been made, but I don't quote me on that. Needs a little bit more research. But there's quite a bit of reference in early days to the maze in the park, and there are not many places it could have been other than here, because there's no flat areas, you see. And I don't think you build a maze on a rough piece of ground.
What would you say the age of the totaras are?
Well, here we go. All the totaras, the ones that are down near the boat shed, and we're standing under totaras now, notably. We're on sort of just below the curve of the Brooklands Drive. And you could be forgiven, couldn't you, thinking that they were, you know, original. It's fascinating. But they're all planted, you know. They would be the same period as the ones that are just near the boat shed, and that would have to have been about the 1880s.
That's unbelievable.
So they're just over 100 years old now. And, you know, there are not many, if you look around, there are not many that are classical timber trees, if you like, you know, single trunks and that. They tend to, in fact, some of them are a terrible mess when they're, even in a plantation planting, they get these multiple heads. Whereas the cowrie, I've always been amazed by these cowrie. Looking back at the cowrie, you can't actually see them from where we are now, halfway up the dell. But if you look at those cowrie, you could put a plumb line on them and they would be dead, as far as I can see, they would be dead straight. Now they're growing on the edge of other vegetation, equally as tall, and in those circumstances you usually get a leaning out towards the light. Those cowries don't deviate one centimetre. Always fascinated me there. The other one, well, it did it to me again. It popped off without telling me it was going to take a finish. So this is, now we take number two, side B, aren't we? And we're in the rhododendron dell at Pukekura Park on our way to Brooklands Bowl. And we're just talking about a big kaikatea, which is at the northern end of the rhododendron dell. The kaikatea, or the white pine, is potentially the tallest of our native trees. And somebody updated me recently, 150 feet, which is roughly 50 metres, is given as the sort of potential height of a kaikatea, but somebody has just recently, within the last year, I think, found a yet greater specimen somewhere, and now I've already forgotten where it was. It wasn't very long ago. So that's a tree, again, that makes a, you know, the wherever there's kaikateas in 100, 200 years' time, they will be very magnificent trees, more magnificent than the totaras, because we have very, very few really classic single-stem totaras in any of the plantings. Now, looking back across the rhododendron dell, there is something of considerable significance too, and that is the fact that there are very, very old kauai trees above most of the rhododendrons. And believe me, if you come up here in August when those kauais are in flower and before the rhododendrons are in full flush, that's quite a sight, because I've seen as many as 10 tuis in one tree here feeding. And the bellbirds, and they're all fluttering around trying to outdo each other for the biggest feed. And it's an added pleasure to this area. And if you stand still, I've heard something here that I've never heard anywhere else. On a still day, you can hear, I don't know, it's not necessarily associated with the rhododendrons, but you can actually hear the insects and the bees, particularly, I suppose, and the insects way up in the, you know, above the trees. You can't see them or sort of pinpoint them, but you can hear the silent drone. Even I can hear it, and my hearing in that pictures is not particularly wonderful. So as we go on up towards Brooklands, the rhododendrons get bigger and bigger, and you're just walking now under one that I do remember the name of, because I'm not a rhododendron specialist, but that is rhododendron not Mount Egmont, Mount Everest. It's a white one, and you can see with our funny weather, I mean, it's very, very mild winter. My goodness, we'll have all sorts of strange things happen with the spring flowers, I'm sure. And that this Everest just starting to pop its buds now, and goodness, we're still not out of July. But that is a white, a very, very old one. See, many of these hybrids go back to the 1930s. But this one is one of the species that you would expect to find if you went to see rhododendrons in Nepal, where many of them come from. This is Rhododendron arboreum, which means the tree rhododendron. And you look at that, there's three specimens here, and they have a character, you know, more substantial than the average hybrid that we have around us. In other words, if you were wanting to keep warm on a cold night in the Himalayas, you go out and chop one of these down. No, you'd probably be a bit wet to get warm that night, but that's the fuel that you would be using there to keep warm. And that's one of the problems of the influx of visitors into those regions where, you know, the locals have to provide food and warmth for visitors, and the rhododendrons are the source of fuel. So that's rhododendron. There's, I think, more than one strain here. You know, there's various ones. It has diversity, but if you look at the things like Sir Robert Peel and these very big growing rhododendrons, you'll find this is probably one of the parents in their breeding. Look above us here at this wonderful specimen of a koa. It goes up into three big branches, and growing on it is an absolute festoon, a waterfall of native orchids. If you came up here in the night in the spring, you couldn't see anything. You'd smell that orchid in flower. It's one of the very aromatic native orchids. We've come out into a little bit of an open space here now. Looking back, and already there's quite a significant rhododendron in full flower there. I can't quite remember the name of that one. Many of the names, you notice that they've gone through for the umpteenth time, I think, and attached labels to them. So hopefully you'll get labels on most of the plants at the moment. Yeah, I can see one over there on that one. So another one on that one, so it's working. until somebody decides that it's time to harvest the labels. But worst of all, the clever ones, the high school boys who are looking for a bit of mischief, and they just switch the labels, don't they? Why pinch them when you can switch them and cause absolute chaos in the world? Much more effective way of getting a message over. Oh, it's a nightmare trying to keep things labelled. Looking up now towards Brooklands Drive from this opening, we see many significant trees. There's a big specimen of our lancewood here. You know, it grows up as a funny little thing with long, great long leaves, over 30, 40 centimetres long. And then as it gets an adult tree, it branches, and the leaf form changes completely. It has a totally different juvenile and adult leaf form. And that's a fairly good specimen of it. They don't grow very much bigger than that. In behind it there is an evergreen magnolia, the name of which has slipped me at the moment. It's magnolia, somebody's name, is it Delavayi? Anyway, that flowers in the summer. It's an evergreen and it flowers in the summer. And then, to me, we have a very interesting row of trees. I think that's an oak in the corner. Might be wrong there, but certainly the next one's a plane. And the next one's an oak. The next one up towards Brooklands is another oak. And then there's an elm at the end. Now, if somebody asked me about possums, and this will show you how very astute possums are, at night they would be down back in the totaras here towards Pukekura Park. They'd shack up in the rimus and totaras and whatever goes in cover. And at night they would come out. And when I started here, this bank was all grass and was mown, and I was a real greenhorn. And there are street lights up Brooklands Drive. And I came up through the dell here one night. I suppose it was something to do with the bowl of Brooklands when the bowl sessions was on, were on. There's a pigeon flying over. Anyway, I couldn't understand how there could be so many cats prancing around up here. I mean, that's how naive and green I was. And there were cats all over this hillside. Yeah, you know. And then I realised later that there were possums. There were so many possums here. Now, I shot out of that third oak tree there, which the farthest from where they would have been overnighting, or not overnighting, overdaying, I suppose they slept during the day. They would have to come from those totaras down there all the way. They don't go through the trees if they can help it. They're pretty lazy and they'll go over ground and then they'll climb the tree they want to. They used to go up to that third oak tree, passing that one and that one. They passed two oak trees to get into that third one. And I shot dozens of possums out of that tree there and hardly any out of these two. That tree somehow had them fixed as far as... And they were very cunning. They used to choose their feeding cycle very carefully. And when I got to know that, I just didn't sort of go around looking for possums. I'd go to the trees where I knew they'd be feeding that week or that month and just shoot them out of that tree. And so it sort of made it a bit simpler in that respect, but that was just by observation and knowledge. But it always fascinated me that they were so selective that they would go past two trees, and that's a distance of an extra, 50 metres to go to the tree that they wanted. I could guarantee that in August when they were in oak trees, they take the buds of the oak before the leaves come. It'd probably be earlier this year, but it was two oak trees that I knew where I could, if there were possums on oaks, they'd be in that one or another one up in the bowl, at Brooklands Park. And I just went straight to those trees. Now, this tree close to us here, which has had some very, very serious amputation just recently, is a sweet chestnut. But it's not the European chestnut, as everybody thought it was originally. It's a Japanese species of chestnut. And it has somewhat larger nuts than the European form. And it took us quite some time to figure that out, because in the 70s, when they started to get very enthusiastic about growing chestnuts commercially, they were out for any clones that were special. And this one, and one that was a little bit further up towards Brooklands, was producing these magnificent nuts. They're not as sweet as the European ones, but very attractive. And they took these and tried to graft them onto the ordinary European form, and they were not, there was what's called an incompatibility there. They didn't graft well, or if they took, they didn't hold. They didn't make trees. And we started to look more closely at them and found, because there was very little knowledge about them, you know, in those days, and they started to look more closely and look up the floras and that, and they found that it was the Japanese one rather than the European one. And this one we call Pukekura, and the other one, which was about 30 metres beyond towards Brooklands, was called Horton, after Tom Horton, who was a great nurseryman and one-time superintendent of the park. But Horton died, 10 years ago, I suppose. And I would say that we were in, because of the great, if you go around, you'll have a look at how much they had to cut out of this one. I would say that that's gone. And this is the story of all the big northern hemisphere deciduous trees in this area. There are so many now that were planted in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s that are dying, one after the other. And that seems to be their lifespan, whereas they'd go for hundreds of years in their natural habitat. In our climate, our quick growth, I think that's about the span of them, because it's happening to chestnuts, walnuts, and a few other significant northern hemisphere trees. Now, the next tree there is a plane tree, and there's a story to almost every tree here as far as I'm concerned. This is one of the biggest planes in New Zealand, I think. Now, having said that, I should be able to give you figures, but I can't. But I believe that there is a report out somewhere that's regarded as one of the largest anyway. And you'll notice that it's provided such wonderful shade protection for this big grouping of rhododendrons. These are a little bit newer, some of these up here. The older ones are behind us to the north. And over the years, Alan Jellyman, a very keen rhododendron person, and Jack Goodwin also, you know, they have kept increasing the collection. The older ones are down near the stream bed and up the hill here. It's been a later development. But in order to fully accommodate the requirements of the rhododendrons, it's been necessary to take these plane trees up, you know, remove lower branches and lift the canopy, as we call it. And then you get the perfect conditions underneath for the rhododendrons. So that's a very important environmental consideration. And as we go round, I'll tell you a little bit more about the detail of that. Now, here we come. We're almost at the halfway point of the rhododendron dell, and we're under a batch of notably totaras. And again, look at the problem trees. You look around the bottom of this one, and I distinctly remember the removal of these branches probably in the 1970s, these ones at ground or just above ground level. Massive branches that we had to take out to give these things a bit of a lift and to clear the ground underneath them, get the clearance underneath. And you'll see there the scars of some of those removals. And look at this remu beside us here. That was a big double header. And boy, that was a bit of fun taking that half out of that tree without destroying all these old rhododendrons to the side. Look at that scar there. It'll take 100 years for that to mend in the case of a remu. But our experience indicates that any tree that goes up with an acute double header, double leader like that, you see we've got one there, with the increasing diameter of each of those two halves, they're actually forcing themselves apart. And it only needs relatively minor disturbance of a... Well, some of them will even go in the course of time just by their own weight of the pressures, because the two halves are forcing each other apart, and the loading of branches and leaves on the outside, they'll just fall to pieces in the course of time anyway. So that's a sad prediction. I see that the lower hut people have been up and doing a little bit of trimming up in that one, which is a little bit odd in a way, but they might have been damaged branches. See, when southeasterly can get into a collection like this, which is protecting everything beyond it to the north, there can be some very severe damage. Now, Cyclone Bola took out some of our biggest rhododendrons, you'll have to believe me. There's some pretty big ones here. We're now just through the totaras and getting out into a little bit more open skyline again. But these trees around us here are very, very old specimens. In this green spot here, there used to be a magnificent big rhodo, one of the biggest of them all, the name of which I can't remember now, but it went in the course of the storm coming through that way from the direction of the Bola Brooklands. Now, there is a lovely stand of Kahikatea there, the white pines in the bottom of that dell, and in the course of the years, that'll be a lovely grouping. In fact, looking down from above, the car park area up at the gables, that is a very, very attractive grouping of conifers, one of which is a good specimen of the Lawson pine, and they look quite wonderful from up above there. And blowing around in the breeze up there, through back up, we're looking back now across to the east towards the racecourse, is one of the remaining Lombardy poplars, and I think that if we looked at that and looked at a map, I think we'd see that that was one of these lines of a road, a paper road across Pukekura Park. I think so, because I can hardly see any reason for that tree being there other than defining a road in the days when that was, must have been, if it wasn't paddock up to here, it must have been paddock pretty close to here. And there's some very big pariri further up there. So I think, like in Brooklands Park, the pariri seem to have been a little bit sacred somehow, and whereas most other trees have been taken down, the pooeries have survived. There's been a planting of sort of herbaceous perennials like primulas in the base here, around the lower areas there. That becomes very wet down there in that dell where the kaikatias are. Now we're beside the most Brooklands orientated plane tree now. There are two big planes left and a third one if we take the one up on the hillside there towards Brooklands Drive. That one to the north, or more towards Pukekura Park, is the biggest one, I think. And I had dealings with this. Another person in the department, whose name I won't mention, had dealings with that first one down there because that was earlier, more significant. Now, you'll notice that the plane tree has a habit of massive trunks and it goes up with big branches. And then these branches hang right down to the ground. And look at them, there's incredible flexibility in that. And when it was realised that some of the big branches that came off low to the ground would have to be taken out to raise the canopy, it was quite a massive job. And in the case of that one down there, when it was done, the thing went out, the branch, were almost trunks, aren't they, but there was a low branch, was cut off, and as it went down and the tips hit, they started to take the loading of the branch coming down and dug into the ground. And as the tension increased on them, the spring, if you like, it threw the butt of the branch that was cut off back at the tree. Very, very dangerous indeed. And that lesson had been learnt when that tree was done. Later on, I came along and I did this one, and you can see the size of the branches that were taken off. This is the scar. It's now completely healed over. And that's, what, over a metre? I think this is a metre long. So that scar is a metre. And in the course of about 25 years, I think when I come to think of it, that particular scar that is completely healed over might have been the one that was done previously, a few years earlier, and I would have done these ones here, which are not quite healed over. So there you are. There you have the recovery of the tree in 25 years or something like that, it's still not healed right over. And the tree has been able to withstand that terrific amputation, if you like. This particular tree has a memory for me because this is the highest I ever worked in a tree, and I had to go up about 40 feet up into that area there and cut off branches that went out over those higher rhododendrons, and it we had to take gear up and, you know, ladders and ropes and chainsaws. I think we had chainsaws at that stage, and it was a hell of a business to get all this stuff up there. And Friday came and I thought, oh, I'll leave the ropes and that up there so that we don't have to re-pitch those on Monday. And I thought, safe enough up there, took the ladders away from down below, and came back on Monday and the ropes were gone. Belief that anybody would go to the trouble of scrambling. I don't know how the hell they did it, quite frankly. It was one of those little miracles that happen in life. There are some very, very beautiful rhododendrons here, of course. There's this one, Louis Pasteur, somewhere around here. I thought was a very pretty one. It's probably this one here. And we're now getting up towards the dam. This was a later development. See, in the 1960s and 70s, the whole of this hillside was mown. It was very labour-intensive. We used to have to send somebody with what was called a gravelly mower, which is a fairly powerful mower. It's got two wheels and a big rotary blade in front of it with a couple of handles. And I always had the admiration for these guys who used these things on slopes like this, because goodness me, they were manoeuvrable, but they were heavy, and they were self-propelled, of course, and they used to cut these rough slopes where we didn't do it every week, of course, but not like a lawn, but periodically these big mowers used to have to go in amongst these plants, and every now and again, you know, somebody would the mower would get it. In fact, we had in a few cases where the mowers got completely away and just rolled down the hills, but that was the extreme. But it was these, you know, to go around these rhododendron plants when it was all grass, they had to go backwards and forwards, and every now and again something would go wrong, and you know, they'd crash into a thing. That was always called Gravely disease if a plant died that way, and it was always a bit of a joke. So now we have got to the point where we have reached the dam which was formed, just as in Pukekura, the two dams were formed to make the lakes down there. So we come to the dam which forms the lake for Brooklands. Now, this is virtually the boundary between this fence line here up to Brooklands Drive towards the Gables, and across the dam face here is virtually the boundary between Brooklands Park, which was privately owned, and Pukekura Park, which was never privately owned. So it's a different world. And you'll have seen already we've passed under those big, ancient Northern Hemisphere deciduous trees, which are not a feature of Pukekura Park, but more a feature of Brooklands. I'm not quite sure about the exact history of the planting of those ones which are in the rhododendron belt we're looking back at now. I think they must have been a Brooklands undertaking, the planting of those. Certainly anything upwards from here is a Brooklands commitment, you know, the Newton King era. And you'll see, looking across the dam, the Saxton Walk sign, and just this side of it, a depression in that very serious flooding we had not so very long ago. That broached there, and we almost lost this dam. it wasn't very far. It didn't have very far to go before the whole of the Brooklands Lake would have emptied down into Pukekura, and boy, that would have... It was a bad enough mess as it was, but if that had actually, it was half of the dam had gone, and it occurred because the natural outflow, the overflow, if you like, goes out round behind that Saxton Wall sign on the eastern side there, and it's only really a small ditch, and it only needs something. You could almost throw a dustbin in it, and it would block it, especially down below because it goes under a culvert. Now, when that happens, the whole of the Brooklands Dam backs up, and if it backs up, and it didn't happen in my time, but it happened this time, it backed up so much, and the rainfall, well, the catchment was so intense that the rainfall was so intense, and the catchment was so capable of creating volumes that it actually overflowed this dam. So that was the little disaster. Interesting things here. Those are Taiwan cherries, Prunus campanulata. And if you want a tree in your garden to bring the tuis and the bellbirds and the wax eyes in the middle of the winter, that's the one for late winter, early spring, if you like. That's one of the very reliable trees. Looking back now again towards the east, northeast, you can see that those skyline Lombardy poplars, which are about characteristic. It's 2 miles for Lombardy poplars here, and they always look untidy. You go down to Queenstown, God, they look magnificent. And in the autumn, they're golden yellow. You never see that here. They look scrappy trees. And they look to be a line, don't they, looking at them from here. So that's that characteristic. This tree just tucked around this rather large rhododendron. Again, we're still looking to the northeast from the dam here. A dark-looking rhododendron tree. That is one of the forms of arboreum. Remember the tree rhododendron that comes from, direct, you know, it's a species from the Himalayas. This magnolia on the dam face here is of sentimental significance to me because beneath that are the ashes of a wonderful staff member here in my time called Vic Swan. Vic Swan was grown up as a real country boy. I don't think he ever wore socks. He certainly didn't wear them when he was here. And a real rough diamond. He wasn't rough in the rough sense, but a resilient character, if I can put it that way. And he, having been on the farm most of his working life, when he retired, came to work as a staff member at Pukekurapa, as many did, in fact. And he was the most reliable and conscientious worker you could ever imagine. And he worked on into his well into his 70s. He didn't ever want to give up working. He was one of the early men to use a chainsaw in Pukekura Park. And that was in the days when you didn't have safety helmets and goggles and all this sort of stuff. You know? And yeah, there was no way you could have got a safety helmet on Big Swan. Oh, we had some funny things happen. One time when we were requested anyway, you weren't obliged in those days, you were advised to wear safety gear. One of the chaps went up a tree to do something with a safety helmet on, and he wanted Vic, I think, to send him up a chainsaw or something he was needed on a line, you know. And he sort of bent over like that to call for his next piece of equipment. His bloody safety helmet fell off and hit the guy below. So things have their side. And one evening, this was when John Goodwin's time and Vic Swan, he was greatly respected by everybody, Vic Swan. And he used to work independently. I remember, I'll go back to another incident. Up in the Goodwin Dell, they were pulling out stumps at one stage, and Vic was on the tractor, and he was a tractor driver. And if you didn't sort of, you know, really keep up with things, Vic would leave you behind. You know, he couldn't tolerate anybody who wouldn't work or hang around. And he was just on the go all the time. And they hitched a log or the stump onto the, it was a log actually, they hitched it onto the chain behind the tractor and said to Vic, okay, she's right, take off. And oh, Vic went out with a clutch and off he went. He did it with such a jump, the log jumped out of his chain and he finished up right down in the park before he realised he's left the log behind. But there's a quite a serious story too about Vic. I think it was up in the woods, the area there we're looking at now. The team had been working up there and everybody gone in and Vic had stayed behind to sort something out. It was typical of him. He'd just work all the time. And John Goodwin was, you know, very mindful of all sorts of things that probably most of us wouldn't even think about. And he realised at 5 o'clock that Vic hadn't come in and checked out, you know, got his gear. And so he went out to see what had happened.